Hello again, I'm Lorenzo again. Today I'm gonna present this other project, which is in collaboration with Thomas Galli and Tomasz Gonda, former Perimeter people.
Is the picture intentional?
No, that's Rui. good. Thanks Rui for the show. So the title is Resource Theoretic Hierarchy of Generalized Contextuality. And what this work is really about is developing a resource theory of generalized contextuality. You might ask, why would we want to do that? We have somehow already established that generalized contextuality is one of the leading notions of non-classicality. And if you're also interested about studying the origin of the quantum computational advantage, you might hope that generalized contextuality can provide some answers. And if you wanna, if you're interested in trying to answer this question, then what you're interested in is not really to just say whether a theory associated to your computation is contextual or not, but rather how contextual it is or how much contextual it is. And if you want to do these things in a rigorous way, then you need to develop a resource theory. And that's what we do here. So what we do is we develop a resource theory of generalized contextuality in the framework of general probabilistic theories. So our objects are this GPT system, so where you define a state space, an effect space, the statistics. And it was known from this work that non-contextuality in this framework corresponds to the demand that your GPT system is embeddable in a classical system. So in other words, it's simplex embeddable. It can be embedded into its state space into a simplex and the effect space into the dual of the simplex. So if you want, the three objects here are the simplex embeddable GPT systems. The free operations are embeddings, so these single-valued linear maps that preserve the operational equivalences. Also, we allow the free access to classical systems, so you can always compose with a classical system. And for us, this is really important because it guarantees that all the non-contextual systems in this resource theory are at the bottom of the hierarchy. So we stress a lot about this hierarchy aspect. So what do we mean here by the hierarchy? We just means the resource ordering, so this pre-order on the resource theory. And if you want to characterize this resource ordering, then you better define a monotone, and that's what we do here. So we associate a real value function to each object of the resource theory that respects this resource ordering. So we call this the classical excess, so it's this function here that basically takes any GPT systems and calculates what is the excess of the system within this classical, infinite classical system. So another way to say this is that it quantifies the failure of your GPT system to be simplex embeddable. Or if you want, what is the minimum amount of noise you need to add to this system such that it becomes simplex embeddable. So we find also other monotones, we find other secondary technically results, but I would like to end with a more foundational note, because this project started because we had this idea of explaining or resolving the interpretational issue associated with contextuality, which is this fact that you have these distinctions at the ontological level that are not present at the operational level. So this mismatch between what is the realist explanation of your theory and what the theory predicts in principle. And our idea was that, maybe this can be explained by the fact that there exists a physical mechanism of erasure of information proper to quantum theory that explains how these distinctions disappear at the operational level. And so can this resource theory of generalized contextuality just present, shed light onto this question? Well, what we can do is to look at, what are the resourceful operations here and understand whether we can interpret them in terms of a process of information erasure. So we have some insights into that, so I welcome you to come talk to me later, but the upshot is that the standard thermodynamic information erasure between classical systems is not gonna hold here. We need to come up with other kinds of processes of erasure of information. So there is much more to say, but I just hope that I made you curious about this research program and our work. So thanks for your attention.
So hello everyone, my talk is going to be probably very short, and the idea is just as Lorenzo did to raise your curiosity. And if you're interested, just go and talk with me, or you can send me a message on Slack and whatever. So I'm going to present a paper that has been published with many people. I'm not going to introduce all of them. Maybe you've seen the name already, maybe not. And the idea is to correct inequalities if you have a noisy experiment, if you have some defects in your experiment, whatsoever. So I'm introducing some useful notions. The sheaf theoretic framework is what we're using, so maybe you don't know it. And next to it, I've put a sheaf of wheat so that you can remember everywhere you see a sheaf of wheat, you can read sheaf theoretic framework, right? So now you know that every time you see it, you have that. So the sheaf theoretic framework is just a framework which is a mathematical framework. It is inspired by Cohen, Sperker, Bell, etc., all the thing that has been done before. And it has non-locality and contextuality embedded in it, like we can explain these behaviors within this mathematical framework. Another notion that you will need is the contextual fraction. So the one just below, it's a quantitative measure of contextuality. So it's between 0 and 1, and it's a convex quantity. So if you have two behaviors that are contextual, if you mix them, then the contextual fraction will be less or equal than the mixture. Right. So, okay, now we're going into the sheaf theoretic framework. So now you should read measurement scenario in sheaf theoretic framework, right? Okay, so the measurement scenario in the sheaf theoretic framework is composed of three mathematical objects, X, a set of labels for the observables, like A, B, A prime, B prime, M, a set of compatible observable, like AB, AB prime, A prime, B, etc., and O, the set of outcomes, so 0 and 1 for most of the experiments we have now. Now, the empirical behavior in the sheaf theoretic framework is represented as a probabilistic table like this. Now, usually you have hidden variable assumptions. So when you try to represent your model as at the ontological level of what's happening in the backstage of your experiment, you have assumptions on your hidden variables. Some assumptions could be outcome determinism and parameter independence. Now, you can relax. You can relax the assumptions. And these assumptions, if you relax them, we invented or associated two values, eta lambda and sigma lambda, that correspond to some outcome non-determinism and the parameter dependence, on the contrary to parameter independence. And the main statement is the following. Like for any measurement scenario, if you have that 2 eta plus sigma is less than 1, then the contextual fraction to this measure of contextuality is going to be less or equal than eta for any hidden variable behavior. So now if you want to have something contextual, something new, you need to have a contextual fraction above eta in your corrected experiment. So these sigma and lambda are like the upper bound of these sigma lambda and eta lambda, sorry. Right, so of course there are a lot of follow-ups. One of the main ones, maybe some questions are interesting for you, but the main one is how do you get sigma and eta experimentally? And this is an open question at the moment, we don't know. So thank you for your attention, or if you read properly, sheaf theoretic framework, thank you, sheaf theoretic framework.
So hi everyone, so I'm Thomas Vinet, I'm a student in Telecom Paris, and I'm doing my master thesis here in Perimeter Institute with Rick Christensen. And today I'm going to talk to you about higher order blank quantum computation. So in the near future, when quantum computers are going to be more available to people and more quantum technology are going to be developed, there's still going to be a distinction between the quantum computer that the majority of people will be able to use, that will have a limited computation power, and the big quantum computer that the majority of companies or research institutes will be able to have access to. So there will be a distinction between those two types of quantum computers. But we could ask ourselves if a client who has a limited quantum computer and a limited computational power could still gain some advantage of those big quantum computers by discussing with it, with the server, without compromising his data, so while keeping his data private. And this type of computation exists, it's called blind quantum computation, and there exist multiple protocols that have already been developed, but the main idea is that you have a quantum state, and you want to make some computation on your gate, on your state, but you don't have the physical implementation of the computation that you want to do. And therefore, you discuss with the server such that at the end, you manage to achieve this computation and to get back the result while keeping your input state private. And there are also some protocols that allow you to keep the computation that you are doing private. So this type of blind quantum computation is basically you have a quantum state and you want to achieve a computation of a gate on it, but we could try to see if we could extend this result to the computation of subroutines. So now the case that we are considering is that Alice, she has a quantum state, and she also has a quantum gate that she can apply, and she has the physical implementation of it, but she does not know anything about it. So for her, it's like it's a black box unitary. And she is interested for her use to transform this unitary into another unitary, which could be defined by a function f. So example of function that are very interesting is that is the control version of a unitary. So given a unitary, find its control version, or given a unitary, find its inverse. And such function can sometimes be implemented by higher order map, which can be described by this circuit. And basically, this means that you have a circuit that needs multiple copies of your black box unitary. It also needs your input state. And if you achieve this circuit with all the box in green that are some fixed unitary defined by the implementation and that do not depend about you, at the end, you can get the same result as if you add at the beginning the transform unitary f of u. So all this this scheme is such that you can actually do the implementation of f without having it. So one protocol that we could consider that comes directly from this case is the case where Alice, she wants to transform her unitary, and she knows the implementation of the function that she wants to do, so she knows all those v0 to vn. Then we could consider a protocol with multiple rounds of communication, such that Alice, she has a step psi, then discussing with the server with the existing blind quantum computation protocols, she could achieve the computation v0, get back the result. Then on the top state, she will apply her black box unitary u. On the bottom state, it's the ancillary part, so she does nothing. And she does the same each time, so for v0, v1, up to vn. And at the end, on the top part, she gets the result that she wanted, while not having access directly to this this higher order map. So this could be a very useful thing. For example, there is an algorithm called DQC1, which allows someone, if you have access to a control version of a unitary, to estimate the trace of the unitary by running the algorithm multiple times. And we know that there exists an higher order map, such that if you give to the higher order map as input a gate that is an extended version of a black box unitary, then at the end you could have the control version of this unitary. So this means that using this protocol, we could find a way to do DQC1 blindly, such that Alice does not know anything about you, but the server also does not know anything about you and does not learn anything about Alice's data. Then the second protocol that we could consider is when Alice, she knows the function that she wants to do, but she does not have the implementation. So one case that we could consider in this case was that there has been a lot of work recently in higher order map for mapping a unitary to its inverse, especially in the group of Miyom Rao and in the group of Xin Wang. But there were some people in the group of Xin Wang that before they were working at Baidu. And we could suppose that we are in a parallel world where they would still be working at Baidu. They don't know, and then the paper would not have been published, and you couldn't know the higher order map. So then they could come to you and say, okay, well, I can do the implementation, I know how to do it, but for me it's quite a secret of my company, so I want to keep the implementation private. So now we have two constraints. The gate u on the step psi of Alice, they need to remain private. And the implementation of Bob, so all the vi, they also need to remain private. And a way of doing this would be to still do some multiple rounds of communication, but such that before each vi, Bob will send some matrices to Alice, such that firstly, the matrices commute with vi, so that Alice can apply one and then apply it back to cancel our effect on our state. Secondly, the commuting matrices do not give away too much information about VI, because commuting with a specific matrix is very restrictive, so find a way to such that they don't give away VI. And thirdly, from Bob's point of view, he gives to Alice a lot of matrices. She chooses one, and from Bob's point of view, when he does not know what matrix Alice applied, it's the same as if Alice has applied some operation that gives to Bob a fully mixed state, so Bob cannot learn anything about it. And if you manage to do this, this means that at any point, Bob cannot learn anything about Alice information, so he cannot learn psi on you. And Alice cannot learn anything about the implementation, so the communication remains private, and everyone keeps their information secure. So thanks for your attention.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to speak to you today. So what I will present is part of a work that we are doing at Royal Holloway in collaboration with Mina at Edinburgh and also my PhD student, Theo, which is also online, I think. Next slide, please. Hopefully by the end of this talk, I can convince you or at least attract your attention to the approach that we are taking towards contextuality and also more general or more fundamental perspectives on quantum mechanics and GPTs in general. So for the moment, what we are dealing with is only prepare and measure scenarios in which you have a physical system prepared in different preparation, using different preparation procedures, and then it's being measured using different measurement settings. And ultimately, what is important to us is something that we call conditional outcome probability evaluation matrices. And these are simply matrices of probabilities for each preparation and each outcome of each measurement. So the columns of this matrix basically indexes the preparations, and the rows demonstrate outcomes of measurements. The only thing that we assume about this matrix is that it's column stochastic, because the sum of probabilities over each row has to sum to one. And that doesn't lose, that's without loss of any generality of the approach. Also without loss of generality, we assume that this matrix is a square. So it's an n by n matrix in general. And we start asking questions about what can we infer from this matrix alone. And probably by making extra assumptions or extra constraints on the physics of the system. In particular, the first thing that we can ask is how is quantum mechanics manifested in this T? And there is a simple answer to it, which is if I know that the system is quantum, then I can possibly tell or put an upper bound on the rank of this matrix that I have. And that's all I need for the purpose of this talk. The next interesting question that I ask is that if I forget how my initial assumption about the theory or the operational theory underlying the physics, then I assume that the system is classical or there exists a hidden variable model or there is some ontological model behind it, then what is the smallest description that I can come up with? Well, it's a feasible question, but we now have a concrete proof that basically finding the smallest ontic description for such matrices is in general NP hard. So so it's an NP hard question to ask what is the smallest ontological model. And in relation to what Lorenzo and Kim said, basically, so this relates to the embedding problem, but without assuming the underlying operational theory. And it turns out that solving the embedding problem in general should be NP hard. It shouldn't be an easy problem to solve, unless you want to have the trivial explanation or trivial ontological explanation. Next slide, please. okay, that's not a good news, but probably a follow-up question is that whether or not we can find lower bounds on the size of the smallest ontic description. And the answer is that yes, we can do that, and there are some number of theorems and results regarding the lower bounds. One of them is the following, which is basically assumes some specific structure on the Cope matrix. Essentially, it says that if I can distinguish between between columns of this matrix only by looking at their zeros or zero entries, then the smallest the lower bound on the smallest ontic space is an integer m such that its central binomial coefficient is larger than n, the size of the matrix. And the second part of the theorem basically states that for any integer L such that the central binomial coefficient is smaller than n, either the ontic distributions or indicator functions, they must span an L dimensional subspace of the ontic space. Now, to give you a concrete example, consider the following. So this is a matrix for one single qubit prepared in 252 pure states and measured in 126 binary measurements, where, as you can see on every block, we only have ones and zeros. So basically this satisfies easily the condition of the theorem. And what we can say is that the smallest integer that satisfies the bound is 10. Therefore, this matrix, any ontological explanation for this matrix requires at least a 10 dimensional ontic space. However, because I know that this matrix has been produced by only a single qubit, the rank of the matrix cannot be more than 4. So I can generate as a very large matrix, basically just using a single qubit. And if I take the asymptotic, you notice that basically this lower bound scales as logarithm with the size of the matrix. So this shows that there is a gap between the quantum dimensionality of the matrix, which is its rank, and the size of the smallest ontological model that can explain the matrix. So this immediately should remind you of Hardy's ontological excess baggage theorem, but this time in a more quantitative way, telling me how the ontological state space is scaling, in fact. Next slide, please. So how does this relate to contextuality? So the idea is very simple. If I want to explain this matrix using an ontological description, I need to decompose this matrix T into two parts. One part is the ontic indicator functions, and the second part should describe the ontological probability distributions. But as I said by the theorem, the ontic function must have a rank of at least 10. The rank of the final matrix must be at least 4, must be at most 4, which implies that the ontic probability distribution must be...
Did you hear the gong?
Oh, no.
Did
I run over time? Okay.
Thank you. We're going to move on.
Yeah, that's fine. Thanks.
Hello. Thank you for making the gong play. So today, it's always good to talk at PI, even if virtually. Today, I want to talk about the work I did in my last postdoc in ICTQT in Gdansk with the several people I have mentioned here. And right now I'm in Naples, and enables pizza is very important. And to make a good pizza, you need to know the correct ingredients for the pizza. Similarly, like for this work, we need to know what the ingredients for this work are. And let me, next slide, please. Let me tell that to you through the slide. I hope that the quality of the slide is good enough. Anyhow, so there's a large literature on communication complexity of functions. So here I have like on the top left side, a schematic for the one-way communication protocol where Alice has some input X and Bob has some input Y. Alice can communicate some message to Bob. And Bob's output, if it has to be correct, has to be some function over X and Y. And the communication complexity is essentially the minimum message, the minimum size of the message you need for the worst of for all inputs, like including the worst ones. And what we do in this work is instead of considering functions, we consider relations where for some inputs over Alice and Bob, you can have multiple correct answers. And now you would ask me, what are the relations we take into account? And we do that by taking inspiration from the literature in chaos contextuality where people use orthogonality graphs. So consider some graph with some vertices and edges. And now you can have a map from each vertex to a vector defined in some field, such that if two vertices share an edge, then the inner product of these two vectors for the vertices is zero. And that's what the orthogonal means here. And okay, and now you can ask what's the biggest subgraph in this graph that is complete. And we say that that's a click, and the number of vertices in this subgraph is in this notation omega. So now you say you have a graph with the biggest subgraph that's complete of size omega, and you have n such clicks in this graph. And now you can also define under these clicks and this graph, the binary coloring from the vertices. So each vertex is given either the value zero or one, such that for any click, there's only one vertex that is one, and every all the other vertices are assigned zero. And now you can map the binary coloring to a click labeling. So for any click, you have a omega valued variable that captures the color of the click. But that's something else in mathematics. So we use the word click labeling here. Let's go to the last slide, please. So now we have all the ingredients. So we can define the protocol. The setup and the protocol. So here we are studying communication complexity of relations. The relation is defined over the graph that I was talking about in the last slide. And here now Alice, the inputs Alice has is some click and some click label for her click. She can communicate to Bob. Bob also has some click. It can be the same or different from Alice's click. And Bob needs to give a click label to his click such that these are consistent, they have consistent binary colorings in the graph. So if Alice has a vertex and it's zero, then Bob, the binary color is zero, then Bob's output should be consistent with that, right? And that's how you define the relation. You take the tuple CXA, CYB, and as long as it belongs to this consistent coloring and click labeling, then we say that the output is valid. And when we ask this question, you can say what's the quantum protocol here, and the way you can think about this is actually very simple. It becomes evident when you lose all the jargon, because Alice's input is what a click, which is a projective measurement in the quantum case, and a click label, which is choosing the outcome of the projective measurement. She can simply prepare that state, send that to Bob, this quantum state, and the size of this would be omega. And Bob does a measurement with respect to his click, so his projective measurement. And of course, he'll get always the correct answer because of quantum mechanics. And so we know that Alice's dimension for the message that she needs to send is omega for the quantum case. Classically, it turns out also it's omega if B is supposed to belong to the relation. So there's no quantum advantage, as you can see on the left side, the bottom left of the slide. So then we consider what's called the strong communication complexity of relations, which says that Bob should basically output all correct answers, because remember that we have a relation, not a function, and there are multiple correct answers. So for the for the subtuple like CXA, CY, Bob needs to, over different runs of the experiment, give all values of the correct values of B. And what this essentially, like operationally, can be thought of is that the tuple CXA, CYB, all these runs are sent to some person, the reconstructor, and they're able to write down the graph again, right? And in this case, the quantum protocol still works, the one I mentioned, but the classical one doesn't. And the size of the message classically that Alice needs to send scales with the number of vertices in the graph. But now you can have omega constant, so the size of the click, the maximum click constant for some graph, and add as many clicks to them, which means that you essentially have omega versus number of vertices, which is an unbounded gap. And this is the quantum advantage we talk about. There are some applications to this, including certification of FUPs that you can find in the work. But I want to focus lastly on the open question that this leads to. And the open question is, where is this advantage coming from? So the graphs we considered need not be KS contextual. So they can be completely colorable and we still get this advantage. And very qualitatively, one can see that from the reconstruction of quantum theory, so like Hardy's paper, that the fifth axiom of the reconstruction by Hardy shows you that the continuity of basis differentiates classical and quantum. And here, to actually have unbounded quantum advantage, you need infinite number of projective measurements. So the open question that I invite the experts in the audience to think about is, can this be related to generalized contextuality? And can that be the advantage? So I'll stop there. I have 5 seconds left. And please ask me questions.
Hi. So this talk is about efficient classical simulation of variants of cluster state computation. It's work I did with former PhD student Sahar Atala and Michael Garn, who's now at STFC, Stanley Yeftich, who's a postdoc, who's now at Faratoform Labs, and Yukuan Tao, who's a PhD student at Dartmouth. Next slide, please. So as I'm sure everybody in the conference is aware, sometimes it's fun to consider operators that are not physical states, not quantum physical states, right? And so in this work, we're going to consider some such non-physical state that we call cylinder state spaces. So if you look at the circle or the figure, the red is the block sphere and a cylinder is the blue shape that kind of protrudes from the block sphere. And that means that it's got operators with negative eigenvalues. So the radius we'll talk about later. But for now, just imagine our cylinders could be of arbitrary radius, right? So why are we going to do this? Because it will transpire that this can give us efficient classical simulations of systems that would otherwise not be obviously classically simulated. Okay, so to understand this, let's start with the definition. So in the red box at the bottom, we've got a definition of what we call a cylindrical computer. And it's basically just the same as cluster state quantum computation, but the inputs are replaced by these cylinder states. Okay, so this is how it works. So in step one, you place, you've got a lattice or a graph of finite degree D. You put some cylinder states on the vertices and you interact them, say with control Z gates, or in fact, any diagonal gate would work, right, for what we're going to discuss. And then you measure each one adaptively and destructively using Z measurements or XY plane measurements, right? And so it's just like cluster states, except we've now got these non-physical state spaces. And of course, we need to worry about negative probabilities, and that we'll discuss later. So can we move to the next slide? So the key theorem or lemma that underlies the whole work is in the top box, right? And it's a fact that comes out of entanglement type considerations that if you take, on the left-hand side, if you take rho A and rho B as being two cylinder states, and you act on them with a diagonal gate, then the output can be represented as a separable decomposition over cylinder state, provided you grow the radius of the cylinders. So if you start on, with the inputs as coming from radius R, then there's some lambda bigger than one for the of an output cylinder that you need to maintain separability, right? So what this means is that as long as you keep growing the size of your cylinders with every gate you apply, there's no cylindrical, what we call cylindrical entanglement, even though they can be quantum pure entangled states, right? And so it turns out that as long as your radii don't grow beyond one, this gives you an efficient classical sampling algorithm to additive error, right? And also a local hidden variable model. And so you can use it to simulate actually quantum systems. So here we have a kind of computational phase diagram. So in the lower box, so if you imagine you've got qubits prepared in some state cos theta over 2, 0 plus blah, blah, blah. And you've got some diagonal interactions that are basically control phase gates, and you measure destructively, then you've got two parameters here. You've got the theta and the phi, two angles, and you can draw a plot. And in this plot on the right-hand side at the bottom, in the top right-hand corner, you've got the ideal cluster state. And you get these curves that are degree dependent, depending on the degree of the graph. And below those curves, you can classically simulate. Okay. And the thing to realize is that these are pure entangled systems. And there's no obvious reason, at least not in our opinion, why they should be efficiently classically simulated. So final slide, please. So just a few kind of speculations and generalizations and stuff. So ultimately where all this comes from is probably that cylinders grow quite slowly when you apply these gates. So they are, and you could ask yourself, why cylinders? Could we choose another state space? And we believe that cylinders are the slowest state spaces in this way. Their radius grows the slowest among all state spaces when you apply these diagonal gates. Got a partial proof, but not a complete proof of that, right? The second generalization is that that all of this generalizes to qubits as long as you've got diagonal gates and certain measurements. And then finally, you can actually do some cross-graining here. So what you can imagine is, imagine you've got a kind of regular lattice, like a square lattice. You can bunch particles into blocks. And so imagine that you've got this red block here, and you can just grow according the cylinders according to which, how many external gates they contact, right? And if you do this, you can get a kind of a block separability on the blocks of qubits. And it turns out that this thing can increase the amount of the region of quantum systems that we can classically efficiently simulate. So indeed, the curves on the previous slide are definitely not tight for certain lattices. Right? And in all of this, we avoid negative probabilities because we restrict our state spaces to be in the dual of the Loud measurement. And one conjecture we have is that for these weird cylindrical universes, for regular lattices, these devices will either give negative probabilities or can be efficiently classically simulated using coarse graining, but we don't have a proof of that. Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Nice to talk here in the conference. I'm going to discuss a little bit about this work that went out in the archive recently, is joint work with Filipe Pérez, Emmanuel Zambrini Cruzeiro, and Ernesto Galvão, that's in the audience. And I am a co-first author with Filipa in this project. It's very fun. So next slide, please. Yeah, so the idea is quite simple. So as systems, quantum hardware become more and more complex, so increasing number of qubits, increasing complexity of the procedures we can implement, we want good ways to certify that this hardware is doing something that is non-classical, okay? And there's various notions of non-classicality. And here I'm going to be interested in magic, okay? It's the one that is associated with the states being outside the stabilizer subtheory, because everything that is inside the stabilizer subtheory is actually simulable classically efficiently. So what's the idea? The idea is that these estimates of two-state overlaps, they are good tools. They are efficient to estimate experimentally. They do not impose too much constraints on how the hardware needs to be. So they can be measured by systems of many qubits in many different ways. And they are robust to noise in the sense that you can estimate even if the states are not perfectly pure or even far from pure. And they have an interesting property, which is unitary invariance. So if you consider the trace between two states and you rotate them with respect to the same unitary, they don't change. So it's an invariant with respect to the reference you write these states. So the idea is actually to create a toolbox of unitary invariants. So it's something that at INL we are trying to develop for all these reasons, because they are good to estimate. And the protocol will be very simple. So we imagine a quantum processor unit that spits out statistics that is described in terms of overlaps. And then if it violates some of these inequalities that we introduced, we can guarantee that the QPU had prepared some magic states, or at least generated some procedures that were outside the stabilizer subtheory. Okay. So next slide, please. And here's the tricky thing. The tricky thing is that standard way to describe or talk about magic is not in a unitary invariant way. Oh, so we need to generalize this a little bit. And we do this by introducing this notion of set magics, the straightforward generalization of a known notion that is set coherent. So what is set magic? So we imagine that we have a set of states, and we will think of this in terms of a relational aspect. And if there exists some unitary or some reference in which we describe all these states, all of them lie inside the stabilizer set, then we say that the set is set stabilizer and they don't have the resource that we are interested in. If this is not possible, so if all of these unitaries applied, there is always one, at least one state that must lie outside of the stabilizer polytope, then we say that the set itself is magic. The set cannot fit within the stabilizer polytope. So now it's a set property, it's a property of a whole and not a property of a single system or a single state system. And here's a simple example in which fun things happen. So if we start viewing this as a relational property, you can start, for instance, with a case where we have four magic states, and there exists some representation in which all of these states, just two of them are actually outside the stabilizer polytope. So with that, and generalizing this to a unitary invariant concept, we can do, we can indeed witness this property of set magic. Of course, if you guarantee that the set is magic, at least one of the states is magic, then you certified magic was generated in the QPUs. So next slide, please. And this is actually the main theoretical result here. So after this sort of foundational concept we are introducing of set magic, we can guarantee that it actually is something meaningful in the sense that not only there exists statistics that witness this relational form of magic that we are discussing, it has various interesting aspects of it. So for instance, you can actually use it to certify the QPU as wanted, but we can also distribute among various QPUs in a network. And then you at least guarantee that some of the QPUs can generate this form of non-stabilizers, because it's now a relational property. It's a property of the whole of QPUs. And more than that, we can also guarantee that depending on the violation of these inequalities, you guarantee that all of the QPUs have the resource. It's sort of a full, we call it full set magic. It means that not only we can witness that some states have this property of being outside the stabilizer polytope, but all of them but one that can always be put inside the polytope are magic or must lie outside the polytope. And it's an interesting property, and it allows us to distribute and learn a lot of these the non-stabilizerness of these QPUs. And moreover, there's this H4 inequality that has the interesting property that not only you witness magic, so if you estimate these overlaps of four states, you also testify non-stabilizers, but that the systems must have a certain dimension. So you certify both Hilbert space dimension and non-stabilizers. So the actual scheme is the one that was always in this right side of my slides. So we have a toolbox of unitary invariants. We can use it actually to witness not only magic, but contextuality, coherence, imaginarity, many things. So if we focus on magic, we actually need to introduce this new concept, the concept of set magic. It may have some foundational interesting implications that we still need to uncover fully. And we have the result, which is we have now an intriguing way, so to speak, to witness this property. So witnessing magic of ensemble of states. Magic is now a property of a whole and not of a single system. And with that, I would like to thank you very much. And if you have any questions, please forward me and or Filippo or Ernesto that is here. Thank you.
Thank you. So thank you for the organizers for the opportunity to present here. So I'm going to talk about non-contextuality inequalities for transformations in prepared transform measure fragments. This is a work done together with David Schmidt, John Selby, and Anna Belen Sainz here at the University of Gdansk at ISTQT. So can you please go to the next slide? Thank you. So before I start, let me mention that in our work here, that we hope to get into the archive soon, we use the language of GPTs. So in that case, the non-contextuality of an operational theory is translated into the GPT fragment related to this operational theory, admitting of an ontological model. So in short, this means that the GPT can be seen as part of a simplicial classical GPT description. So now when we go to fragments on the left here on the slides, we have a prepared measure fragment. And as the name suggests, this means that we have a preparation procedure, which prepares some states in our GPT, then some measurements, and then we get some outcomes with some probabilities, which is represented by this closed diagram here. So if this fragment admits an ontological model, then we have a simplicial GPT describing this procedure. And not only we need to recover the same probabilities, but also this operational identities, which are analogous in the GPT formalism to the operational equivalences, should be also satisfied in the ontological model. So they translate as linear constraints on the ontological model. So previous work have shown how to get all the non-contextuality inequalities for the prepared measure fragment. And what we do in our current work is to generalize this for the prepared transform measure fragment, which we call PTM fragment. So as soon as you start considering composition of processes more generally, there are some subtleties that appear. And these subtleties, they take the form that the operational identities start to look nonlinear. And this may be a problem, at least if you want to have efficient programs to calculate things. So for now, what we do is that we only consider the operational identities that have this linear form as we got in the prepare and measure fragment more naturally. So when we consider only these linear constraints, the ontological model for the PTM fragment has also to abide by some linear constraints. So now what we get, and please, if we can go to the next slide, is that we get a linear program. And this linear program gives us non-contextuality inequalities, which, as we discuss in our upcoming paper, in some sense can be considered to be necessary and sufficient in very specific conditions. But in general, they give us witnesses of non-classicality for general scenarios. So I'm sorry, the slide there's a mistake. It's a witness of non-classicality. So if you violate one of these inequalities, you know that your GPT fragment exhibits contextuality. And then what we do is that we apply these methods that we construct to the single quantum stabilizer subtheory. This is an interesting fragment because in the prepare and measure scenario, it is known to admit of a non-contextual ontological model, but it's also known to have contextuality in its transformations. So here we show using our method that we can actually get a transformation of contextuality inequality already in the PTM scenario that is violated by the single quantum stabilizer. So that's interesting. We also discuss a few things about how to use these tools for the PTM fragment to have some conclusions for more general scenarios like PT1, T2, T3, and so on fragments. And I'm not going to enter into details. If you're interested, please send me an email or a message or something. But it's actually nice to go beyond the prepare and measure scenario and find some witnesses of contextuality there. Thank you very much for the attention.